Like a lot of other people, I've been watching what's going on with Dr. Jordan Peterson over the last months and years with a combination of wonder and confusion and hope and fear and just all kinds of strange emotions about what in the world is going on with this guy. And specifically, what I mean is his struggle with the question of God's existence. And I think that he is on a path towards having some sort of a conversion, some sort of a change of heart. And Pigweed and I discussed this a bit in the episode called Jordan Peterson and Martin Luther, or Jordan Peterson as Martin Luther II. But today I want to take a different approach to it, and I want to reduce it down to this. It seems to me that the bottom line, what Jordan Peterson is experiencing, is that either God is real or the universe is accidentally and unwittingly deceiving us. And that's a big claim, and I'll try to support it with some arguments here, but I want to take you back to an experience that I had in high school. In high school, I was an atheist, and I really loved physics. And I liked the idea, I sort of imagined the universe as a clockwork thing. That natural law, or I'm sorry, the laws of physics would operate on the things in the universe, and you could tick things forward and see what would happen next, or if you had a strong enough computer, imagine this: if you were to take two pool balls off a pool table, and nothing else existed in the universe but these two pool balls, then you could calculate what would happen to them, right? They'd be attracted to one another by their mass, their gravity. They'd come together, they'd hit, they'd bounce back off, they'd go some distance, and then they'd be attracted and come back together again. And you could calculate exactly what was going to happen with those two pool balls forever. And eventually they would come together and they would be stuck together. And I imagined the universe that way. It was more than just two pool balls, it was lots and lots of pool balls, right? But I figured it wasn't really any different in principle than two pool balls. It was just all these objects that were interacting according to set laws. Now, I know some of you are going to think there's quantum uncertainty and all that kind of stuff. Okay, fine. I'm not trying to make the case that my view of the universe was correct. I just want you to get the attitude that I was having at the time. The attitude was that there's this clockwork universe. And the laws would act upon things and they would go a certain way, and you could predict exactly what was going to happen next. And I thought, okay, that makes sense with the Big Bang, and that makes sense with star formation, and that makes sense with the formation of solar systems and the formation of the Earth. I was into geology also at the time, so I knew a lot about the history and the structure of the Earth. And I thought, well, how does life change that? Well, early life was just a bunch of chemicals that came together. They're still just operating according to natural law. They're not just the laws of physics, they're the laws of chemistry, right? So chemical law would determine how things would interact with one another. It's not like the early life forms had a choice. It's just these chemical forces behaved the way they did and did what they did, and that. So it was a very deterministic clockwork view of the universe. And I try to kind of ratchet it forward. How does that change when it becomes a protozoan or a bacteria? Is it really different? Does a protozoan have free will? Does a bacteria, does a virus have free will? I thought, no, it's all just a clockwork mechanical universe. And I kind of worked my way through that. What about a fish? Tried to work my way up, sort of up the ladder of complexity when it comes to biological systems. And I thought, well, somewhere along the line, it changes, doesn't it? Because otherwise, the logical, necessary, deterministic result of this clockwork universe is me sitting in English class wondering about what the clockwork universe does. And as soon as I got to that point in the argument, it all just evaporated. I just thought that is the dumbest thing that anyone has ever thought, ever in the history of the universe. Obviously, A clockwork universe doesn't produce a sentient conscious being sitting in English class. You know, what does that mean, English class? What does natural law have to do with English class, right? The idea that these natural laws operating on this clockwork universe would result in some arrogant, stupid kid in high school sitting in English class thinking that he understood how the universe worked, right? It was just crazy. And I immediately realized that there was a flaw somewhere in the scheme, right? Maybe the universe isn't clockwork. Maybe something else is going on. So I'm raising that story because I think something somewhat analogous is what's going on with Dr. Jordan Peterson. And that's what I want to discuss. So I don't believe Dr. Peterson has formulated an argument. Maybe he has. I don't know. He's a smart fellow. Maybe he has formulated an argument. I don't believe that he has, but I see things that he says in different contexts and in different places on different subjects. And it seems to me that they create an argument that he may be aware of or he may not be aware of. And I think the basic structure of the argument goes something like this. We assume a lot of things that we don't even realize we assume. We're generally speaking unaware of the structure of our own perceptions. Modern science is starting to unpack some of these things, but our very perception of the world has certain implications to it that we don't understand. And a lot of those implications, those assumptions, those things that we bring to the table about our perception, pardon me for the stupid little noises that come up from time to time, when we add them up, they end up sounding a lot like God is the thing that unites them all. God is the uber assumption that makes all of these other smaller assumptions fit together. Now, most of the classical arguments about God don't deal with these sorts of things because it's only recently, it's only, I don't know how long, but this century, well, the last 100 years anyway, that we're starting to understand insights into our awareness and our introspection and how we view things and how we understand things. All of these assumptions, I want to make this very clear, all of these assumptions can be explained from a purely materialistic, evolutionary, naturalistic point of view. They all can. Everything that I'm going to say here today can easily be explained from an evolutionary, naturalistic point of view. But in a way, you end up with the same situation that I was in 12th grade English. Are all these things just happenstance and they seem to indicate something? Is that an accident? Are these assumptions just misleading? Are all these things confusing and deceiving us? If it's true that all these different arguments, which I'll go into in depth in a minute, if it's true that all these different things kind of lead us toward the idea that God is the assumption that pulls it all together, why in the world is that? Is the universe designed to deceive us? Or is it possible that these assumptions are signposts to lead us to God? Now, I'm not taking either case one way or the other. I'm just trying to explain what I think I see going on in Jordan Peterson's mind. And I'm going to go through several of these elements that I see in Jordan Peterson's thought that I think lead to this sort of an argument. So the first part of this progressive argument that I'm going to try to build here is that you need context. You always see the world through a lens. You have a perceptual set to organize the world. For example, if you were dropped on another planet, you wouldn't know what you're looking at. You wouldn't know where the land ends and the sky begins, for example. You might see changes in color, but you don't know, are there trees or are those foothills? You may have had the experience driving up towards a mountain where it's kind of unclear exactly what you're seeing, but you have to have this perceptual lens in which you understand the world. I had this experience the other day. I was at a Dunkin' Donuts, and I saw something on the floor that looked like a key. It had the general shape of a key, but it was too thin. It was too thin to be a real key. And I looked at it for a while, and I couldn't figure out what it was until I finally realized it was one of those plastic things that you stick in the hole in the lid of your coffee cup to keep the coffee warm, right? And if I wasn't in a coffee shop, I might not have ever come to that. If I was in a hardware store, I might have had a different set of assumptions about what this thing laying on the floor might be. Of course, I could have walked over and picked it up, but I was looking at it from a distance and trying, wondering, what is this thing? You have to have a frame of reference. And in your life, there are a lot of things like that. When you run into another creature, do I eat it or does it eat me? Right? Do I mate with it? The fight or flight instinct, right? And your perception is related to action and movement. Dr. Peterson says that when you look at something, it's like that thing imprints itself on your mind in such a way that you think, how would I grasp it? So the world isn't so much made of objects as it is made of tools. It's things, tools in a certain context, things that we use. So we view the world from within a certain framework, from within our human consciousness. And there are a lot of things that influence us in how we encounter the world and other people. So now, if you've listened to much Jordan Peterson, I'm sure you've heard him speak about those kind of things. I'm not going to try to explain it all here. I'm just going to mention that as one part of the argument, that there is a context to the world. The next part is that you need to have goals. And this isn't like a motivational thing, you have to have goals, you lazy bum. No, it's like a fact. You have to have goals because perception requires a goal. In order to perceive something, you have to have a filtering mechanism to sort out the things that you perceive in the context of goals. You don't see objects, you see goals, tools, obstacles. And when you have these goals, that also implies values. For example, why get out of bed in the morning? You have to have a goal. You have to have something that you want to do. Maybe it's eat breakfast, but you have to have everything that you do is oriented towards a goal. And you look at things based on how you would use them in the context of a goal. Now, this is sort of, I'm not sure this fits exactly in this section, but there's this thing that Dr. Peterson likes to say. He says, let's play a game. Okay, you move first. It doesn't make any sense at all, right? Because there's no context, there's no rules, there's no goal. A game only makes sense if there are rules, if there's a goal, if there's something that you're going toward in a certain way, right? And life is very like that. And apparently, I'm not a biologist, so I could get this wrong, but from what I understand, this is all deeply biological. You point your eyes at what's important, and that signals to other people. That's one of the ways we communicate with other people, is where we point our eyes. It's one of the ways we train children, is the way we point our eyes so that they understand what we're perceiving, what we're looking at. And it's a way that we train ourselves. So you need to have goals and you need to have a purpose. Now, the next part of this is goals imply value. I mentioned before that you have to have you have to have a reason to get out of bed, right? Well, things are sort of endless in every direction. Like without a framework of value, you can't decide where to focus your attention. You have to focus your attention on the thing that matters. It's like if you've seen the video of the people passing the basketball back and forth, and the gorilla walks in and beats his chest and walks off, and many people don't see the gorilla. And the reason they don't see the gorilla is because what they're supposed to be doing is counting the number of times the basketball's been passed. That's their goal. That's their framework. That's their value, is counting the right number of times the basketball's been passed. And they miss the great big gorilla that steps in the middle. It's really a fascinating thing. It's sort of like you go into a room. Let's say you go to a lecture and you go into the hall, and you come out later and someone asks you, what color was the carpet? Well, you saw the carpet and you knew what color it was, but because it didn't matter to you, it wasn't part of your value structure, it wasn't something that was important, you didn't really pay attention to what color the carpet was, or what color the walls were, or what the weave of the fabric on the chairs were, or any number, hundreds and hundreds of things that you might have noticed, but you didn't, because your value structure was focused on other things, sitting next to the pretty girl, listening to the lecture, taking good notes, all that sort of stuff, right? The reason that you move and the reason that you do something is because you want to go towards something better. So all of our life is embedded in this hierarchy of value. It has to do with the way we perceive things, it has to do with the way we remember things, it has to do with everything. When you go into a room, you notice the things that are valuable. And value teases the question of ultimate value. If we're going to have this hierarchy of values, this is the thing that's important to me here, this is the thing that's important to me there, does that imply ultimate value? Now, Nietzsche, when he talked about the death of God, said that what that means is the collapse of the highest unifying value. See, there has to be something that unifies our values. Well, what's that going to be? So the next step in this progression is that value implies ethics. Jordan Peterson said, you cannot perceive the world except through an ethical framework, or at least a framework of value. If we value one thing over another, it implies that one is better, right? When we think of a king or a mother or a leader, we extrapolate from particular kings, particular mothers, and particular leaders to an idea of the ultimate or perfect king, mother, or leader, right? And we hold that up as a standard, as an icon, or as an archetype. Now, this gets into Platonic realism and all kinds of other weird questions. Does that archetype exist in any real sense? You know, everybody has to take the particulars and extrapolate from that to some other general thing. What is a mother? Well, no, not Mary, not Sally. You know, you're not talking about a particular mother. You're talking about motherhood. What is motherhood? And here's, I want to get back to the point that I raised earlier, that all of the things that I'm discussing here can be explained from a purely naturalistic evolutionary point of view. Dogs have to do what I'm saying right now, right? You know, they have leaders of the pack, and they have a concept of what the leader is supposed to do. And if the leader doesn't do that, they fight them. At least I think so. You know, I've read a few Jack London stories. But humans and animals have to come up with these hierarchies and these archetypes and these images of what the leader is supposed to be, what the king is supposed to be, right? Well, all these things imply an ethical framework. If you listen to Jordan Peterson, you've heard him speak about this a lot. And I'm not going to try to reiterate everything he says. I'm just trying to frame them all in the context of what I think is going on in his mind. Now, ethics are also tied in with our emotions. Plans are associated with our emotional perception of the world, and when they're disrupted, we get upset. We like things to be consistent with our ethical view. Belief systems regulate our emotions. When something contradicts our belief system, it makes us uncomfortable. You can look up a video on YouTube about Triggle Puff, and see what I'm talking about there. All this adds up to having some sort of a map or a story. Everyone lives inside a story or a myth. They live in, take all these things together. It's a map, it's a story, it's a myth, it's an archetype, it's an explanation of how the world is ordered and how you fit in it. Now, what will that story be? How does it tie in with all these other things, like the archetypal king and all that sort of thing? In another conversation, I believe this was with Jonathan Pageau, Dr. Peterson was saying that, or maybe it was Pageau, was saying that everybody has a "what would Jesus do" meter in their head. Not that it's always Jesus, you know, maybe it's "what would Muhammad do," or "what would Solomon do," or who knows what. It's like the pack dog looking up to the alpha dog, except that we've extended that to some form of conceptual alpha dog, right? What is the ultimate human being supposed to look like? And then we measure ourselves against that. What would the perfect person do in this situation? And our sense of the good is tied in with the attention that we give to the world. It's a question of who we're imitating, who do we think we should be? Now, once again, all these things can be explained from a purely naturalistic perspective. I'm not trying to make an argument for the existence of God here. I'm really not. I'm just trying to explain how I think all these things fit together in a way that might make someone go that direction. Now, some Christian apologists like to say that science can only exist within a philosophical context that justifies belief in an orderly and understandable world. That is, the world is not chaotic, but follows fixed principles, and we're capable of understanding those principles. And some people will say, well, how could that be unless we're created in the image of the God who created the world, and we're somehow participating in God's nature or whatever. Now, I wonder, just as a side argument, I wonder if the argument can be made the other way around. In other words, if the world is in fact orderly and understandable, then that makes us suppose the existence of God. And that trick, that looking at it one way and then looking at it the other way, is really the point of this whole argument that I'm trying to present here, which is you can look at it from either perspective. And I'm not telling you one perspective is right or the other perspective is wrong, but I'm trying to get you to see how these things sort of, when you add all this up, taking all these things together, they start to sound like this ultimate being that tells us purpose and direction and meaning and perception and all these other things that we know have to have an important part in our lives. Now, another thing that just came up recently, it was in Dr. Peterson's interview with Joe Rogan. If you go to about the 1 hour mark, maybe 55 minutes or so, they start talking about music and music as a sense of meaning, because there are multiple patterned layers and they communicate and they cooperate and you participate in that. That music sort of gives us an intimation of genuine meaning. It puts us in touch with that meaning. It allows us to observe this sort of harmonious interplay of patterns and then asks us to participate in it. And that reminded me a lot of the beginning of the Silmarillion, where Tolkien seems to say that the world was created out of music. So there's a connection there. There's another thing that I don't understand as well, and I'm not going to spend much time on, but you might think about this one too, and that is psychedelics. Because Dr. Peterson seems to spend a lot of time wondering about magic mushrooms and hallucinogens and the shamanic tradition and all these insights that seem to come out. So he says, I don't know, never done psychedelics, don't intend to, and I don't know much about it. But he seems to be saying that there are these insights that come out of these psychedelic experiences that turn out to be real, which is a very strange thing. It sort of reminds you of the situation where, you know, you imagine the math geek writing an equation on the blackboard, and the biologist walks in and says, yes, that's exactly how an octopus regulates its skin color. You know, there are these weird connections between, math, pure math, somebody just manipulating numbers and equations on a board, and the real world. Well, is it possible that there's a connection between, you know, some things deep in our brains that we don't even understand that psychedelics bring out or whatever, and deeper meaning? You know, all the things that we've been talking about, that what I started off at the very beginning was that you need context. You have to have a perceptual set to organize the world. Now, we're not like animals that have an act by instinct. We think about things, right? So to some extent, there's this bubbling up from inside us of, rather than just, oh, I do this because my instinct is telling me I want to do that. No, we actually think about it, right? We're aware of that we're hungry, that we want to eat. What am I going to eat? Maybe I'll eat this, maybe I'll eat that. Some animals don't, you know, they don't think. I can't imagine that a paramecium thinks about what to eat. It just sort of does what it does. It feels motivated to go this way rather than that, right? So there's something in our brains that in humans is kind of bubbling up into consciousness, and we're just starting to come to grasp with all these things. So I think the psychedelics is another part of this this thing. There's another component that you've probably heard Dr. Peterson talk about, which is the idea of these archetypes these things that are conceptual, that we can imagine, in some situations, being actually manifested in the world. And Dr. Peterson talks about the logos all the time, and he talks about the logos being manifested in the person of Christ, that's what, you know, that's what C.S. Lewis would argue, that all these myths and archetypes and ideas about the ultimate person and everything else, all the myth became fact. And apparently in his practice, Dr. Peterson is a Jungian psychiatrist and has had a practice where he helps a lot of people. He's apparently, he says, seen situations where these archetypal things actually become manifested as realities in the world. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but he thinks that, and that's in his head. So this idea of this ultimate archetype, this ultimate meaning, this logos, this thing on which we base our perception and our values and everything else, being manifested in one particular person, seems to fit with all those things. Now, so I think that's the general scope of the argument. And I want to go back to my point at the beginning, that none of these things prove the existence of God by any stretch of the imagination. It's entirely possible that the happenstance of the universe led us to a state where belief in God is sort of implied just because of the way things turned out evolutionarily. You know, we're pack animals and we look up to the alpha dog and all these other kind of things might imply the existence of God. And that might explain why belief in something like God and religion is fairly universal, that everybody has it because we all have the same nature, we all have the same wiring underneath, and all these things kind of bubble up that way and point us towards God. So it kind of comes down to this question. Do you believe the universe is trying to trick you, or do you believe the universe is trying to give you a message? And I think that's my understanding. I think that's what's going on with Dr. Jordan Peterson and why he is having this deep, long-lasting struggle over the question of his belief in God. So that's my take on it. I'd appreciate if you have thoughts, if you agree or disagree, have something you can add or whatever, let me know. I'd like to hear from you.